Hey, Dan here. Dear listener, if you enjoy 40 Minutes in the Old Testament, I'm guessing that you would enjoy some of the other things we have going on at the new ChristHoldFast.org. We have a new article up every morning, Monday through Friday. We have 5 podcasts, a video cast, and we're doing a conference in February. There's other things we want to do, and all of this takes an enormous amount of time. All of this content is free, but we do need to be able to hire somebody to help us manage it, to get it out on time, and to keep the quality high. If these resources have been helpful to you, please consider going to Christ Hold Fast and clicking on the support page. There you can make a one-time donation or a reoccurring donation of any size. This will help us meet our goals of being able to bring someone on staff. Everyone at Christ Hold Fast would greatly appreciate your support. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I've completely cashed in on trying to remember what number episode these things are, but it's the latest one, and Brandon is out of town as we're recording this and not able to record. So I am.
He's with us in spirit. I'm pretty sure
he is. He is with us in spirit. But so obviously I am joined though by Chad Bird as usual.
Here I am, ready to go.
I've been waiting for the day when Chad's out of town and me and Brandon decide to just go with it. It'd be a totally different feel.
Yeah, we should do that. We should do that.
So, Chad, we're starting a new chapter this time.
We are turning over a new leaf. Yeah, we're unrolling the scroll just a little bit more. We've actually completed chapter 20, so chapter 21 of Genesis awaits. It's calling our name.
Well, answer that door.
All right, well, let's do it. You know, we actually been waiting a long time for this chapter, longer than anybody listening to this program realizes. We've been waiting 25 years, a quarter of a century, for this chapter. Because that's how long Abraham and Sarah have been waiting. We're at the point, finally, after 25 years of waiting, for this son to be born to Abraham and to Sarah. So we finally have a birthday to celebrate. I guess we've celebrated Ishmael's birthday, but that one doesn't count as much as the birthday of Mr. Laughter himself, Isaac. So that's where we are. Got a lot to talk about here. There's really kind of 3 different things that go on in this chapter. You got the birth of Isaac, then you have this clash of wills between Sarah and Hagar, and Hagar and Ishmael end up getting sent off into the wilderness. That's the second story in this chapter. And then we have one third story in the closing verses where Abimelech, if you remember him, he comes back into the story, and we have a little conflict between him and our friend Abraham. But first of all, let's get to this first story. It's the first 7 verses of chapter 21. I'm going to read a couple of verses, and I want you just to kind of listen to something that seems to come up several times here. Genesis 21, "Then the Lord took note of Sarah, as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had promised. So Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abraham in his old age, at the appointed time of which God had spoken to him." So 3 times in those 2 verses, we hear more or less an affirmation that finally God has made good on the promise of his word. It said that the Lord took note of Sarah as he had said, and he did for Sarah as he had promised. And it happened at the appointed time of which God had spoken to him. So it's like Moses can't say enough about the fulfillment. I mean, this is, and the reason he does it is because this is against all human expectations. It's against the laws of nature. It's against doubt and unbelief. Against all of that, the promises of God finally come to pass. And as we talk very often on this program, really what God has been doing for the last quarter of a century is undoing Abraham and Sarah. He is reducing them down to nothing. He is waiting so long that it is laughable, incredibly laughable, that a child would be born to this couple. Because remember, Abraham is 100. He's a century old, and Sarah's right behind him at 90. There's no way, absolutely no way, that this couple's going to have a child. It goes against everything we know, everything we believe, you know, all everything we know about the body and medicine, everything. There's no way this can happen. Mm-hmm. So it really, God has brought us to the point to where the only way this is going to transpire is by a miracle, is by God himself bringing this to pass. So it really is, it's almost like this is a sort of Good Friday. A death has taken place. And so God has reduced them down to nothing, to death, in order that now, finally, they can have an Easter in which life springs up out of death. God works through his creative word to bring to pass that which didn't exist before. You know, that's really Dan, what if you think about what Paul's talking about in Romans chapter 4, when he discusses Abraham, that's kind of the point that he's making there. So Romans chapter 4, verses 16 through 17, he gets to talking about how the promise is by faith and by grace. And he's talking about Abraham in this section. He says, in hope, against hope, he believed in order that he might be the father of many, many nations. And then listen to this verse. And without becoming weak in faith, Abraham contemplated his own body, now as good as dead, since he was about 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb. So out of death, God brings forth life. Out of the deadness of Sarah's womb, out of the deadness of Abraham's body, comes forth this promised seed. In fact, Luther has this great line in his commentary on Genesis. He says, what thus far has been an object of hope, and what he has believed, this is now a reality. And if I may express it in this way, the promise has now been made flesh.
Yeah, yeah, the good and dead is the way that is the kind of thing that God likes to work with.
No, that's the perfect material for God. He's killing to make alive. He's reducing to nothing in order that from that nothing he might bring forth everything. So what he does in the opening chapter of Genesis is the same thing that he continues to do. This is simply the way that God works. You trace it all the way from the opening chapter of the Bible, all the way through the lives of the patriarchs, the life of Israel, the birth of the Messiah, all the way to Revelation. This is the way God works. He creates ex nihilo. He creates out of nothing. And the reason he does that is because that's the only way that he can work with us. You know, if we had something to cling on to, something to hold on to, if we had something instead of no thing, then we're always going to be clinging to that one thing that we have, because we would think that because of that we have what we have, because of this thing that we've done, because of this integrity or righteousness that we ourselves possess, because of this life that we ourselves have somehow earned, because of that we receive the promises of God. Because of that, God works through us to do what he does. But that's not the way that God works. Just like he didn't make the heavens and the earth out of some kind of pre-existent material, so he doesn't bring our created life, our created faith into existence out of some kind of pre-existing material. He always works out of nothing. So he takes, before we come to faith, we're dead. We're nothing. I mean, there is no kind of spark of faith or spark of the possibility of faith within us, which the Spirit sort of fans into flame and creates a real faith out of that. No, God looks within us and he sees within us the same thing that he saw before creation. There's nothing there. God speaks, and he makes faith in us.
Yeah, this is why Jesus, when he taught, you hear all the time, you hear people talk about, you know, mustard seed of faith and all this kind of stuff, mm-hmm. and which is interesting because Jesus says, if you have the faith of a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, be uprooted and cast into the sea, which is not Jesus trying to promote mountain moving. What he's saying is quite literally, you don't even have that much faith.
Mm-hmm.
In and of yourself, you don't have the smallest seeds worth of faith. It doesn't exist because, I don't know about you, I haven't seen a lot of people throwing mountains into the sea. The whole thing is, apart from me, you've got nothing. I mean, even if you had the smallest amount, you would be doing miraculous things, but you don't.
Yeah, it's got to be that way, because otherwise, I mean, we live with a lie. We live with this idea that we do have something, right? We think that apart from Christ, we have something. We've got to have something. But we don't.
You got sin. That's what you got.
You got sin. Yeah, like Luther says, what do we contribute to our salvation?
Sin and resistance.
Sin and resistance. That's what we contribute to our salvation. Yeah, I mean, if you put together all of the images of people apart from Christ, apart from faith, it's this weird metaphor. You know, we are by nature children of wrath. We are dead in our trespasses and sins, by nature enemies of God. So it's kind of this weird dead person who's also actively resisting life, if you can imagine that. That's who we are apart from Christ. And so God must, by his word, create faith in us and transform us from enemies into friends. It's all he's doing. We're all like Lazarus in the tomb, dead and unable to get out of it until Jesus says, Lazarus, come forth, Chad, come forth, Dan, come forth, whatever your name is, come forth. In that very word is the life-giving power of God that creates what it says, because that's what God does. God is the creator, and he creates by speaking.
Yeah,
he created faith in Abraham and Sarah the same way.
Yeah, I just preached on Lazarus recently, and it's interesting when they get to the tomb, he's in a cave,
mm-hmm.
with a rock over the front. Now there's not like a back way out of this cave.
Yeah,
and they got like a rock over the front. So this is a dead guy in a place that there's no escape from.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been in there for 4 days, and when Jesus gets there, he tells him to roll away the stone, and they say, oh, there'll be an odor.
It's gonna stink.
It's gonna reek in there. And Jesus is like, perfect.
It's just what I want.
It's just,
I want him dead and stinking.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. And like, yeah. Rolls that thing away and walks in there and like just walks right into that stench, into like all the filth that is us, the decaying corpse that we are. He just breathes it all in. It says, come forth. And like that's what he does.
And if I remember correctly from the story, Jesus delayed coming.
Yeah, intentionally. Yeah, so that he would.
Yeah,
so it would be so. Yeah.
Yeah. God has this frustrating habit of delaying. I mean, we're 25 years with Abraham and Sarah, however long it took for Lazarus to die. So he delays the fulfillment of his promise in order that he might reduce us to this Lazarus-like state, because that's the kind of material that he works with.
Yeah, he delays in coming so that Lazarus will die, but when he shows up, he weeps.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that the reason he tarried was that the glory of God would be shown. Mm-hmm. And this is an interesting thing that first of all that God does wait. He weeps and waits, so it's not. It's he hates death. He hates it. And it's a painful thing. He is moved by the situation that we find ourselves in, where we're suffering, then we die and this kind of stuff. This is not something that God thinks is good, and it's something that this breaks the heart of God. yet he does this crazy thing that where in the midst of death and decay and stench is where he says the glory of God is most manifest. It's in the midst of all those things that the glory of God is most clearly seen. And we see that most clearly then at the cross, in the midst of, you know, the cross is a horrifying event. I mean, these crosses, they don't give you like some shiny new cross that they just cut down from some nice timber. They reused these things. You carry this splintered cross up a hill with the blood and urine of 100 guys before you on it. Mm-hmm. And they nail you to it naked, and all the sins of the world placed on it. It's this horrifying, crude event, but yet at the same time is the place where the glory of God is most clearly seen. And this is the same with Lazarus in a tomb full of the stench of rotting flesh. He says this is where the glory of God will be manifest, and that's the backwards thinking of God, that He creates life out of death is where we see His glory most clearly. This is where He's most glorified in the word of resurrection.
Yeah, and that runs so contrary to what we expect, to what we often hear. In fact, I have conversations on a pretty regular basis with people about, for instance, why we were created, and a lot of times people will say, "Well, we were created for the glory of God," and I will agree with that. But the problem is, how do we understand the glory of God? Because it's not as if God created us in order that He might just kind of boast in Himself, "Hey, look what I did." The glory of God is manifested in His acts of mercy toward us, which are hidden under suffering and shame.
God did not. We were not created because God was somehow. His glory did not. It was deficient somehow.
Yeah, he needed a few more trophies on his wall.
That's not it. He did not, and he's not a glory hound either. He's not. He didn't say like, how can I get the most glory for myself? This is what I'll do. That's not the goal there, because that's my goal. That's why I do things. That's the motivation I have for everything. And I don't think God is very much like me, and so I don't think He's like, how can I best get all the accolades I can? Because that's very much like we are. Instead, like, it gets flipped, and God creates children to receive gifts from His fatherly hand. They fall, they rebel, they hate Him, and then He goes and He suffers on their behalf to bring them back to Him, out of mercy and love for this creation. And in that, this right here will cause you to say, well, that's a glorious God right there. If the motivation behind all that God does is love for his creation, well, that's very different than me. And that then ultimately glorifies God. Where God, like, this is me, then I can say truly, well, that's a glorious God. Like, that's so, it's other than me. That's so not like me.
Yeah, there are what we think of as glory and the way that God is glorious could not be more opposed. When we seek glory, we always are moving upward. We're climbing upward in a way that benefits ourselves. But God is always going down. Luther says in his commentary on the Magnificat that God cannot look above because there's no one above Him. Neither can He look to either side because there's no one who's equal with Him. So God always looks down. And the farther one is from Him, the more clearly does he see Him. So the way that God manifests His glory is by coming down to us in our rottenness, in our death, in our stinking nature. And there He manifests His glory precisely in showing love. That's how God shows his glory. He is glorified. He shows glory by giving, by bestowing love upon the undeserving, by saving us in a glorious way, which is to say, in a loving and a merciful way.
He is glorified in His humility, which is contrary to everything we think about.
Yeah, yeah. Thou art a God who hidest thyself, as Luther often refers to that verse from Isaiah. God always hides Himself. He's always doing things in what seems to us is an ungodlike or even anti-godlike way. Why? in order that we might learn to live by faith, because we have to trust that what God speaks, what God says he's doing in a glorious way is in fact him doing it in a glorious way, even though it appears to us to be full of death and ugliness and simplicity and suffering. But that's the way God works. Just like the birth of Isaac is a glorious birth, because it's God alone who does it, and he does it through this elderly couple, 190 years old. But the birth of Isaac is a glorious birth because it reveals God's mercy and his love in this most unexpected way toward this couple.
Yeah.
And they laugh. And I love that. You know, we've seen them laugh. Abraham laughed when God told him that Sarah was going to give birth to a child. Sarah laughed when God visited them and told Abraham that Sarah was going to have a child that next year. And those were both almost laughs of incredulity. They couldn't believe it. They were laughs of joy, but incredulity as well. But here we have Sarah saying, God has made laughter for me, and everyone who hears will laugh with me. And that's why he's named Isaac, Yitzhak, because to sahak is to laugh. He really is the child of laughter. This is a huge occasion for simply expressing joy by laughing at the sheer surprising nature of God's way of bringing life out of a dead womb. So Isaac is sort of he is an embodiment of the grace of God.
Salvific hilarity.
Yeah, he's hilarious. You know, everything that Isaac is should not have been. There's no way that Isaac should have been born, but he's born because of the promise of a gracious God who brings life out of death. And so he embodies the grace of our Father. And that reminds me, in the last episode, I kind of wrapped things up by talking about how I wanted to discuss how Abraham was himself sort of a prophetic embodiment of the life of Israel. And I think this is a great story to illustrate that. Years ago, I studied at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, and when I was there, I studied with rabbis. We studied a lot of the early Jewish writings and learned a lot of really interesting things. One of those was a saying by the rabbis that the deeds of the fathers are a sign for the sons. And by that, they meant that what happened to the patriarchs was a sign or kind of a prophecy of what was going to happen later on to the sons. And by that, they meant Israel. So the life of Abraham parallels the life of Israel. So that as we've been going through these chapters, beginning with Genesis 12 and on through the rest of the story, there's amazing parallels between what happens to Abraham and what's going to happen later on to the nation of Israel. Just think about it. Abraham is promised a son, a seed, and Israel is promised a son, a seed, the Messiah. But both Abraham and Israel, they have this long period to wait. Abraham has to wait 25 years of his life before finally this promised seed is born. And Israel has to wait for centuries before the promised messianic seed is born. We talked back in Genesis 12 about how Abraham had his exodus down into Egypt, got in trouble with Pharaoh. Pharaoh got plagued, and then Abraham comes out of Egypt with all these Egyptian goods. That's the same thing that happens later to Israel. They go into Exodus in Egypt, get in trouble with Pharaoh. God plagues Pharaoh. They come out of there enriched by all of the riches of Egypt. And then you got parallels between Abraham and Israel as well, because their sins that we've talked about, the sins of Abraham with Pharaoh, the sins of him with Abimelech, and then you look at the history of Israel, and it's the same kind of thing. They're always acting contrary to God's words and promises and getting themselves into trouble. So if you look at the life of Abraham, it is sort of everything that happens to him is itself, his life is like a prophecy of what is later to happen to Israel. And as we'll talk about when we get to the next chapter, chapter 22, it finally comes to its pinnacle in the sacrifice of the promised seed. So Abraham and Israel wait all these years for the promised seed to be born, and then when he's born, he's taken to the mountain to be sacrificed. And yet he lives. Isaac is spared, and Christ is sacrificed, but resurrected. So there's kind of a rich prophecy that's interwoven in the life of Abraham, so that what we see him doing is a prophecy of what is to come.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Let's go on and talk about the kind of the next thing that happens here. I think we've got plenty of time. All right, so we have Isaac being born. Sarah's laughing. Abraham's laughing. Everybody's laughing, except there comes a time when some laughter takes place that Sarah is not too pleased about. And this is beginning here in verse 8 of Genesis 21. So it says that Isaac grew and was weaned, and Abraham makes this great feast, have a party on the day that Isaac is weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, mocking. Now, the Hebrew word for mocking is actually a form of the root for laughter. So we might, I guess in English, you might say he was making fun of him, or he was laughing at him. It's the same root that we've seen all along in connection with Isaac. So he's in some way playing upon his name, but in a negative way. You remember that Ishmael was, of course, the first son of Abraham, born to Hagar. When they kind of made this deal, they got tired of waiting for God to fulfill his promise. And so they said, hey, why don't we just let Abraham go into Hagar's bedroom, and together they'll make a baby. And they did. And Ishmael is born. So Ishmael is about, I don't know how much older he is than Isaac, quite a few years. And here he is mocking Isaac. And earlier we saw how when Hagar conceived Ishmael, that she began to look down on Sarah. So you got mother and son kind of both having this haughtiness about them. Ishmael, because he's the firstborn son. Hagar, because she was able, as a slave, to get pregnant with her master and to bear a child, even though her mistress, Sarah, was unable to. So whatever's going on anyway, it's creating conflict, because Sarah is not happy with Hagar or with Ishmael. So she says to Abraham, drive out this maid and her son, for the son of this maid shall not be an heir with my son Isaac. Now, you remember that this is the first time that Sarah got rid of Hagar. And the first time that it happened, Abraham really didn't seem to be that upset about it. But this time it says the matter distressed Abraham greatly because of his son. So you got this conflict brewing. You got Sarah, who's against Hagar and Ishmael. And now you got Sarah kind of going after Abraham. And Abraham's caught in the middle because, well, Ishmael is his son. You know, he loves his son. And so he doesn't want to get rid of his son, but also at the same time, he's got Sarah after him. So I have no envy whatsoever for Abraham at this point. He's the last person that I would want to be in this situation.
This is like a massive conflict in your very, very old age. And just like, man, I'm too tired.
Like, I'm too tired to deal with this drama.
Dude, I got women fighting. I got illegitimate kids. I'm 100 and something years old.
Yeah.
It's just too much, man.
Yeah. Most men, I think it's probably safe to assume that most men, when they're 100 years old, do not have two women fighting over them. It just doesn't happen. But, you know, I was thinking this morning that Abraham, the more the story goes on, almost the more pitiful Abraham becomes. And I mean that in the sense of that I'm full of pity for him, because he gets himself, or he's put into these situations that nobody would want to be in. You know, nobody wants the kind of drama that he's facing right now. And yet here he is. And certainly no one is going to want what he has to face in the next chapter when God tells him to go sacrifice his only son, his promised son, Isaac. But that's where he is. And thankfully, God intervenes. And in the midst of Abraham's distress, God says, don't be distressed because of the boy and your maid. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her, because through Isaac, your descendants shall be named. And then he goes on and he says, the son of the maid, talking about Ishmael, the son of the maid, I will make a nation also, because he is your descendant. So more or less, God is telling him, hey, whatever Sarah said to do, do it, because I'm going to take care of this. First of all, it's not through Ishmael, it's through Isaac that your descendants are going to be named. It's through Isaac that the promised seed is going to come. And by the way, I'm also going to bless Ishmael in a different way, but I'm going to bless him because he is in fact your son. So what does Abraham do? Now this is fascinating to me. This is verse 14 of chapter 21. It says, Abraham rose early in the morning, and he took bread and a skin of water, and he gave them to Hagar. Now listen to this. I'm reading now from Genesis chapter 22. After God tells Abraham to take his son, his only son, whom he loves, and to sacrifice him, it says, verse 3 of chapter 22, so Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey. So in both cases, you have a divine word coming to Abraham to tell him, more or less, he's about to lose his son. In this case, it's Ishmael. In chapter 22, it's going to be Isaac. But in both cases, this is a terrible trial for Abraham. That's why I said earlier that he becomes really this pitiful character, one for whom we're full of pity, because in both cases, he is faced with the dilemma of losing his son, his sons, in his old age. But in both cases, he rises early in the morning. He gets up, and he actually does what God tells him to do. So he takes food, he takes water, he gives it to Hagar, and gives her the boy, and he sent her away. So she leaves, and she wanders in the wilderness of Beersheba. Now, what's going to happen to Hagar and to her son? Now, in the account that follows here, it's pretty interesting. If any of you have Luther's commentary on Genesis, you ought to read this, because he takes this occasion to go on a pretty extensive commentary, as Luther is wont to do, about how this story illustrates for us the way in which God uses the law and the gospel. Now, you wouldn't expect that. I mean, what does the story of Hagar and Ishmael wandering in the desert have to do with law and gospel? But I'll give you a thumbnail sketch of really what Luther's talking about. And I think he's spot on here. I mentioned earlier that you've got Hagar and you've got Ishmael, her son, and they both have this sense of entitlement. I mean, Hagar goes from being just kind of a no-name slave to being the mistress, the co-wife or concubine or whatever she is, to Abraham. And whereas Abraham's wife, Sarah, is unable to conceive, she conceives. So she sees herself, she begins to look down upon Sarah. So she sees that because of the child that she has, because of her connection with Abraham, all of a sudden she is beginning to be full of pride because of what she has. And then you have Ishmael. He begins to mock Isaac, even though Isaac is the promised son, because Ishmael sees himself. He's the firstborn. He should be like Cain back in Genesis chapter 4, who got angry at Abel. So he's full of this kind of firstborn pride in himself. So they both are identifying who they are on the basis of what they have, of their station, of their entitlement. So what does God do? He sends him out into the wilderness so that in the wilderness he might preach the law to them, if you will. He brings them to the point to where they give up. They think that they're about to die. What happens in as the story goes on is that the water in the skin, their canteen dries out, and Hagar is so distraught that she doesn't even stay with her son. She puts him down under one of the bushes, and she goes a little ways off, and she says, "Don't let me see the boy die." And she sat opposite him, and she lifted up her voice, and she wept. So it's a terrible scene. They're out in the wilderness. They're out of water. She puts her son under a bush, basically to die, and she walks away and sits there weeping and crying. So they're really both at the point of hopelessness and despair and death. And as Luther points out, that, and as we talked about earlier in the hour, that's exactly where God wants him to be, because it's exactly at that point that God appears. God hears Ishmael crying, and the angel of God calls to Hagar from heaven and says basically that God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. He tells her to lift him up, to hold him by the hand. He's going to make a great nation out of him. And he opens Hagar's eyes, and she sees this well of water. And she goes and fills up the canteen with water, and she gives him a drink. Now, this is a fantastic illustration of the way that God works. You know, he's taking these people who have this sense of entitlement, who are filled full of pride, and he puts them in a situation in which they realize that they have no life within themselves. They see themselves on the point of death, and it's precisely at that point when God graciously appears to them, opens their eyes, speaks words of life to them, and actually gives them water that brings them back to hope and to life once more.
Yeah, God is God will bust your kneecaps to show you mercy. This is the way he is. I mean, mm-hmm. As soon as you think you've got a leg to stand on, he busts that sucker out.
I've had a few kneecaps busted.
Yeah, yeah. I've been like, this leg feels pretty good. This is pretty good. I think I can stand on this, and then sure enough, I end up flat on my back, bleeding out. But this is what God does in order that he might show you mercy, that he might show you just how dependent you are. Mm-hmm. Self-dependence is the enemy of grace, and so he gets rid of all that to give you what you really need, and that's what he does here. He gives you the law, and he crushes you with it. And then he comes and opens your eyes to the life-giving gift that he has provided for you.
And I love the fact that in a lot of these Old Testament stories, this gift comes via water. You know, you have it here. There's this well that he opens her eyes to see this well, and she has water, and there in that water she has life. You think of the Israelites. You know, they're out in the wilderness. They're dying of thirst, and so God tells Moses, "Hey, strike this rock," and out of this rock flows this ocean of water for the Israelites there in the wilderness. And these are fantastic stories that really flesh out for us the way that God still works, because that is the way that God still works. You know, he finds us in the midst of death, and he says, "Hey, I've got some water. And through this water, I'm going to give you life," because it's what he does in baptism.
Yeah,
he finds us dead, and he enlivens us through the water of baptism.
Yeah, he's all about that ordinary, boring stuff that you need. I mean, he is a God that provides you with what you need, and it's usually not flashy, even though it's miraculous. I mean, even manna is like an incredibly miraculous thing. I mean, it's literally raining bread.
Yeah,
it's pretty miraculous. It's also very boring because they get sick of it pretty quick, and they're like, "I don't know."
Yeah, it's just bread, right? It's not like T-bones were flying out of the sky.
I mean, I don't know, God. I mean, it's all right, I guess.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, it's
But this is what he's using to save you. And we do the same thing. I mean, we want something super flashy, but he gives us something boring and miraculous at the same time. He's like, well, here's water, and mm-hmm. here's bread and wine. It's not anything special, but it is miraculous.
Yeah, and that's fits with the way that God always works. We talked about earlier. He hides his glory. He hides his miraculous glory beneath these common, simplistic, ordinary things. Just like he hid himself beneath the common flesh and blood of Christ. He's manifesting his glory in hidden ways, in simple ways, just like he does here with the water to Hagar and to Ishmael.
And we are out of time.
That's it.
That is it. So we will be continuing. What do we have next? What do we have next, Chad?
Yeah, we got we've got this story between where Abimelech, if you remember him, he's the one who took Abraham's wife Sarah the second time. We have a little confrontation between them, which we'll probably go through pretty quickly. But then we are really coming to the chapter of chapters, to Genesis chapter 22, when Abraham is told to sacrifice Isaac. Nice. A lot of good stuff there.
So back to our boy Abimelech, and we get Isaac. That sounds good. All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining us, and we will catch you guys next time.